The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, and the main headline, Life Sciences Awards. Leading the way in life sciences, former LabCorp CEO David King awarded with Lifetime Achievement Honor for his decades of work that propelled the life sciences industry in the state. And in this Life Sciences Awards section, we'll read the Lifetime Achievement Award winner, and then other articles if we have time at the end. The headline inside the Triangle Business Journal, How David King Shaped and Led. During his 12 years running LabCorp, David King transformed the company from a U.S.-focused diagnostics lab to a global life sciences giant. And this is written by Zach Ezone. A few months after he retired, the global life sciences company that David King helped shape and led for more than a decade would begin playing an integral role in the U.S. response to the pandemic. Burlington-based LabCorp began running tests for the novel coronavirus in April 2020, and by the fall was running hundreds of thousands a day, King says. The pandemic highlighted the importance of an industry that he has been deeply involved in for more than two decades. I really believe the lab industry saved the country because of the ability to test and get people treated who needed to be treated, says King, this year's winner of the Triangle Business Journal Life Sciences Lifetime Achievement Award. The company's efforts in responding to the pandemic included developing an at-home kit that allowed people to take and mail their own nasal swabs to labs for testing. At the height of the pandemic, there was a tremendous demand for the test called Pixel, King says. But the test development was somewhat unintentional. Prior to the pandemic, LabCorp was pursuing an at-home blood draw project, of which King was a big advocate for years, but found it challenging to make work. As the virus was spreading throughout the country, LabCorp took the infrastructure it built for the blood draw project and tailored it to work with a COVID test instead. It was luck, not skill, that we had done all of that development work on a home testing project that turned out to be the right idea but the wrong application, King says, but we were ready to go. The company was ready to respond to the pandemic because King had spent the years leading up to his October 2019 retirement focused on making sure the company had the right leaders in place in the right roles. He was preparing for an exit after spending nearly 20 years with the company, including 12, as CEO. I always think that every person you hire should be better than the person you're replacing, he says. Also, as a CEO, you shouldn't be afraid of having people who are better than you in roles because that's how you build a succession team. Path to CEO. King's long tenure at LabCorp, during which the company transformed from a U.S. diagnostics firm to a global life sciences giant, can be traced back to his time as an attorney for the firm Hogan & Hartson, now called Hogan Lovells, in Baltimore, where he practiced for more than a decade in the 1990s. King went to law school at the University of Pennsylvania on the advice of his mother, who was also an attorney, after he spent a few years teaching high school. After graduating, he spent a year as a law clerk and then moved into private practice before spending a few years as a federal prosecutor in Maryland. King then moved to Hogan & Hartson, which provided legal counsel to LabCorp as it dealt with allegations over fraudulent lab billing practices to the federal government. The company settled the case in 1996, agreeing to pay $187 million. After assisting the company with its legal issues from the outside, King joined LabCorp as its general counsel and chief compliance officer in 2001. He spent 3 years in that role before taking on more business-specific responsibilities like strategic planning and corporate development. This natural progression led to King becoming the company's chief operating officer in 2005 and then CEO in 2007 after his predecessor retired. This wasn't the career pathway King had in mind when he applied to law school, but it worked out all the same. In hindsight, it turned out to be a very wise decision, King says, but at the time, I can't say I had all those thoughts in mind. Moving from an outside attorney to the company's general counsel and then to business side of LabCorp took some adjustment, he says. For instance, as an attorney, King would make recommendations from a legal perspective on certain decisions, where as an executive, King often had to make decisions on his own. I learned nobody likes an executive who just brings all of the decisions that have to be made to a committee, King says. You have to have a point of view and make the call in a lot of cases. Transforming LabCorp. His role as a decision maker grew even greater as King stepped into the CEO role and had an opportunity to really shape the company. While he saw the opportunity for growth in the testing lab industry, which was LabCorp's sole focus at the time, King pushed for the company to create different sources of revenue. This strategy ultimately led to LabCorp's acquisition of Covance, a contract research organization, for about $6 billion in 2015. The acquisition transformed LabCorp from a North America-focused lab testing company to a global life sciences firm involved in diagnostics and drug development. The deal caught Covance employees by surprise, and Wall Street analysts weren't sure about the deal, King says. People were skeptical of how the two companies fit, one being focused on diagnostics, the other a CRO. But King says LabCorp had a level of conviction that two-thirds of the business would mesh seamlessly, and the other third, involving advanced clinical trials, could be done successfully by focusing on and growing into areas where LabCorp excelled from a diagnostics perspective, like oncology and infectious disease. As CEO, he made many trips to Covance sites overseas to discuss the deal with employees and introduce them to and pitch them on LabCorp science. "We had to get over the initial hurdle of, these guys are lab people. They don't even understand our business," King says. "And all of those things are part of any acquisition, but obviously the scale of this one made it more challenging," he says. LabCorp has since flourished. In 2013, the last year Covance filed an annual earnings report, the company saw a revenue of about $2.6 billion. That same year, LabCorp's revenue was about $5.8 billion. Last year, the combined company's revenue surpassed $16 billion. Stepping away. Following the acquisition, King began shifting his focus on making sure the company had the right leaders in the right places and then building a succession plan. After retiring, he hung around LabCorp for a bit longer, advising his replacement, Adam Schechter, and helping with lobbying and regulatory work during the early days of the pandemic. King officially stepped away July 31, 2020. After leaving LabCorp, King spent some time in private equity and began a consulting business. He has also joined numerous public and private boards for companies covering various aspects of the healthcare industry, including medical devices, vaccine delivery, and physician engagement. "I've learned a lot about areas of healthcare that I wasn't close to when I spent 20 years relentlessly focused on the lab business," he says. During those 20 years, King says there's been an interesting progression in North Carolina's life sciences industry, an industry he helped shape. While some larger companies have scaled back their operations in the state, more smaller and innovative firms have popped up in their place. "People I know that used to work at GlaxoSmithKline or Johnson & Johnson are now working at small biotechs or small CROs," King says. "And we still have some big companies here, IQVIA, LabCorp, PPD, but the innovation environment is really amazing." And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Residents surge in downtown Raleigh. Only a few years ago, Raleigh's downtown struggled to gain traction or even a grocery store, in part because the resident population downtown was small. But that changed in a big way in recent years, and more dramatic changes underway as the city's urban core undergoes a significant revitalization. Towers are still going up for new office space, although the future of pricey office space remains uncertain. But what is clear is a rush to live downtown. All this really started to take shape in Raleigh over 2015 to 2016 when, as a report from the Downtown Raleigh Alliance notes, about 1,800 residential units delivered, including Sky House, The Lincoln, and more. The Central Business District had only around 5,000 residents in the year 2000, a number that has since doubled, according to the DRA's Q1 market report. That number should grow to 16,000 or more within 4 years. To put that in perspective, that's roughly the size of Pinehurst living solely downtown. Meanwhile, the DRA reports there are 1,456 residential units under construction, and another 5,535 additional planned or proposed. All that means new energy and vitality for a city where, not long ago, Fayetteville Street was a pedestrian mall with more pigeons than people at dusk. Irregardless owner adds to portfolio. The owner of the popular Irregardless Cafe in Raleigh has purchased a restaurant near downtown with plans to open a new concept. Falafel & Company, a Mediterranean restaurant and market, was recently bought by a local business team with plans to rebrand it as Brookside Bodega. The restaurant is located in the Shops at Brookside Retail Plaza at 1000 Brookside Drive and has been open since 2019. The new owners, including Irregardless Cafe owner Lee Robinson, will transition the space into a neighborhood hangout spot with handheld food items, wine, and retail offerings. Robinson launched the restaurant along with his wife, Michelle Robinson, and Daryl Brown and Jacob Paramo. The spot is currently open and continuing to operate as Falafel & Company, although under new ownership, and will transition to the new concept by June 10. From First Tee to Green, some 100 golfers comprised of area business leaders converged at the Raleigh Country Club on May 16 to raise money for the First Tee of the Triangle, which held its annual golf outing after more than 2 years of hiatus because of the pandemic. Collectively, the group, along with event sponsors, raised some $185,000 to support the nonprofit's mission of teaching children life skills and character development through the game of golf. Deloitte's Doug Baker, Carson Baker, Ted Almasy, and Tim Fleischman took home the first prize. Local and regional business leaders such as Cam McCray, owner of Kinston-based Tans Incorporated, Brian Reed of Town Bank, former Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina head of sales John Roos, and McConnell Golf Club owner John McConnell were among the golfers spotted on the course. First Tee currently is running a $7 million plus capital campaign, of which only $1.25 million is left to be raised. The nonprofit served more than 1,700 children in 2021. Shaw lands grant to restore former medical school. The National Park Service has awarded Shaw University a $500,000 grant to restore a historic building on its downtown Raleigh campus. The money will fund the rehabilitation and restoration of Leonard Hall, which opened in 1883 and housed the university's medical school for more than 30 years. The building now houses the university's School of Divinity and the Center for Racial and Social Justice. After the medical school closed in 1918, the building continued to operate as a classroom space until a fire destroyed its roof in 1986. The building was restored and reopened in 2000 through donations and a federal grant. From Whirligig Park to the NC Arts. After a stint in Wilson leading the Volus Simpson Whirligig Park and Museum, Jeff Bell has a new job. The North Carolina Arts Council has named Bell its new director, and he steps in at a time when the arts community in North Carolina is eager for a return to normalcy after the brutal hit of the pandemic. Bell has more than two decades of arts experience, including leadership positions at 21C Museum Hotel in Durham, Cam Raleigh, and Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. Jeff Bell's hands-on experience in using the arts to stimulate creativity, enhance quality of life, and spur local economic development have prepared him to ably lead the North Carolina Arts Council, stated Reed Wilson, the secretary of the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. And finally, funny name, laudable act. As tech firms deal with a tight triangle talent pool, one CEO is trying to get to technologists early. Really early. Mark Self, president and CEO of MPro5, is for the sixth year in a row teaming up with Cary Academy. MPro5 is offering rising seniors work-study internships over the summer. The plan is to host 10 students starting May 23. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Destination Desertery. Even as inflation eats into discretionary income, the owners of Annalore's German Bakery are betting on artisanal quality. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. On a typical Saturday, the clientele at Annalore's German Bakery in Cary is as much a reflection of its old-world heritage as the storied pastries, authentic German recipes, and the building itself, which co-owner Norbert Stattenbauer conceived with an eye to creating a design that could fit perfectly into any European city. This place is a confluence of different ethnicities. We have customers from all over Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Poland, Czech Republic, anyone who loves authentic German rye, sourdough, or pumpernickel bread, he says, adding there are also frequently customers of South American heritage, particularly Brazilian or Argentinian, who he's discovered have particularly sophisticated palates. You find people from all walks of life and all nations here on weekends. Many have international business partners, so they travel to Vienna, Brussels, Amsterdam, and when they are back home in Cary, they find us. Home is a relative term, given that the bakery has a loyal following of customers from as far away as Fayetteville, as well as across the triangle from Durham and Chapel Hill to Wake Forest. We are a destination bakery, not a convenience stop, Stattenbauer says. What he finds most interesting is how strongly the artisanal German bakery products resonate with ethnicities that are outside the European and American culture. As an example, he cites one of the best-selling delicacies, the Prinzregentin Torte, a 7-layer sponge cake interlaid with apricot preserves, topped with chocolate ganache and adorned with a flake of edible 14-karat gold. It's a feat of culinary workmanship that entails 32 distinct steps. This is a cake for royalty. It was first created in 1886 in my hometown of Munich in honor of Prince Regent, and it is wildly popular with people from the Indian subcontinent, Stattenbauer says. Not only with people from India, but also from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Kashmir. And the chocolate pistachio shortbreads are also popular with people from the Indian continent. He and his wife, Anna Laura, came to the U.S. from their native Germany in the 1980s, initially spending 25 years in New York working in culinary and hospitality jobs before relocating to the Triangle in 2007. They opened their first bakery that same year at the State Farmers Market. In 2018, their flagship Cary location opened, and now the products for both locations are created in Cary. Anna Laura is the heart and soul of the bakery. She is the creative force behind all of the pastry items, and I do the breads, Stattenbauer says, noting that many of the recipes come from their grandparents or even more distant ancestry. German breweries and restaurants owned and operated by Anna Laura's family date to 1665 and are located in the southern part of the country near Ulm. We do not modify German recipes. We are authentic, artisanal. For example, the level of sweetness in our products is at European level, so much less sugar, he explains. Artisanal means we have standards that are not driven by profit optimization. You cannot accelerate certain items. Bread needs time. I don't take shortcuts. Passion drives the production, and the Stattenbauer's day starts at 3 a.m., 7 days a week, so the freshly made products can be manufactured at the volume needed to meet demand. In large-scale industrial bakeries, automation keeps throughput flowing. At Anna Laura's, the owner's commitment to heritage and old-fashioned values define the process. As he notes, artisanal is the opposite of industrial. The market for high-end premium foods has flourished in recent years. In 2021, the U.S. artisan bakery market was worth $25.7 billion and is predicted to surpass $30 billion by 2028, according to market research firm Brandessence. In 2019, industry experts estimated revenues at upscale bakeries range from $325,000 to $450,000 annually. In 2012, they purchased the property where their bakery is located with financing from Fidelity Bank and a vision to create a rock-solid business. An existing building was demolished all the way through the foundation, and the new steel structure was constructed to pristine standards with a stone facade that replicates a classic European style. It is a cultivated place that encapsulates our operation and is more about the sentiment. The environment invites you to do exactly what you would do in Europe, in Munich or Zurich. You would take a few minutes out of your busy schedule to have nice coffee and pastry, he says. Natural light floods the predominantly white-on-white setting via tall arched windows, and coffered ceilings reinforce the subtle suggestion of a sophisticated, refined experience. Pre-pandemic, people criticized the bakery's spacious retail area, but the design proved ideal for social distancing, and the dedicated entrance and exit doors on opposite sides of the dining area made it easy to maintain customer service at the counter or curbside. The kitchen equipment is imported from Germany. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get all new energy-efficient equipment, and that contributes to our excellent sanitation rating, Stattenbauer says. In the last three inspections conducted by Wake County, and Alores has scored a 100 sanitation rating. The challenge has shifted from the challenges of customer interactions during the pandemic to the supply chain interruptions. It is beyond description. I've never seen anything like it before. And then inflation is something else. We're squeezed from both ends, he says, describing prices that fluctuate weekly, sometimes daily, often 30 to 40%. This is not inconvenience. It goes to the core and it affects everything, Stattenbauer says. Sometimes it is just the price and other times it is availability. If I cannot get ingredients, then I'm really in a bad position because I can't make the product. Now, it is all erratic prices and sporadic availability. We can pass a fraction of inflation cost on to consumer, but there is never the possibility to have a corresponding price increase. Even as inflation eats into discretionary income, Stattenbauer believes the loyal customer base that appreciates artisanal European authenticity will continue to make Anilores a destination of choice. One of the biggest challenges, even more than inflation and supply chain disruptions, is labor shortage, he says. We are constantly looking for top talent at every level, from dishwashers to professional pastry chefs. And there's also two news items in the 52 Shades of Success section. First Asian American cabinet secretary dies. The first Asian American to serve as cabinet secretary, Norman Y. Mineta, passed away on May 3rd at age 90. Mineta, who served briefly as commerce secretary under President Bill Clinton, became the 14th U.S. Secretary of Transportation in January 2001 and was the longest serving secretary in the history of the department. One of the highest profile Asian American political leaders, he also served as mayor of San Jose, California, and as a 10-term congressman. During his tenure as transportation secretary, Mineta helped create the TSA, and on 9/11, he led the process of grounding all planes in the U.S. airspace. There was no emergency protocol in place, but under his leadership, all 4,638 planes in the air were grounded in just over 2 hours. Celebrating African American heritage at Durham Festival. The Bimbe Cultural Arts Festival, honoring African and African American history, culture, arts, and traditions, will celebrate its 52nd anniversary on May 21 from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the grand reopening of Durham's Rock Quarry Park. Presented by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina in partnership with Durham Parks and Recreation, the free, family-friendly event will include live music by R&B star Mario and by North Carolina native and NC Central University alum Sunshine Anderson. The first Bimbe Cultural Arts Festival originated in 1969 when a group of African American students from Duke University, North Carolina College at Durham, now NCCU, and members of the community envisioned the festival, which was held in the Duke Gardens. Over the years, as the festival grew in popularity and attendance, the location transitioned across several Durham venues, culminating at the Rock Quarry Park. And now we turn to the On Tech and Finance page written by Lauren Onasorge. Triangle bankers make leap to crypto. Two tenured bankers with decades of experience. Two leaps into the flashy world of crypto. A pair of financial startups have similar stories. The founders were drawn into entrepreneurship by the rush of blockchain. In Raleigh, Tim Whitney, a longtime veteran of Wells Fargo Advisors, took the plunge by starting Tradewinds. In Apex, Pawan Mishra, a 17-year veteran of Fidelity Investments, took the leap to start Mudra Capital. They're two completely separate startups, but proof of the enticing allure of crypto, even as the digital markets are in the midst of a major collapse. Tradewinds. After 18 years at Wells Fargo, Whitney left to start Tradewinds, a financial services firm specializing in traditional planning and investment management, but also in the crypto space, something that could never really take a front seat with his former employer. There's this radical technology that if you speak the language, it can really open up the next wave of the future, he says. I'm all in. The plan is to continue to offer traditional financial planning services while also delving into crypto for those keen on the wave. What we don't want to do is turn a blind eye to what is probably going to be on the forefront, on the cutting edge, Whitney says. I want to be on the cutting edge. Mudra Capital. Mishra has a simple reason for leaving Fidelity, the bank that brought him to the Triangle from Boston. I left Fidelity to help people like me invest in crypto, he says. So Mishra and his partner disclosed three token investment funds this month under the Mudra Capital umbrella via securities filings. There will be a day when your day-to-day experiences will be in a virtual world, he says. We are going to be more and more virtual. The amount of time people are going to spend in the virtual world is going to exponentially rise, so there is a huge demand for metaverse applications. Chapel Hill's Union Grove launches third fund. A Chapel Hill investor whose portfolio successes include Beyond Meat and Poshmark has closed on a third fund in hopes of making more winning bets. Union Grove Venture Partners has disclosed what it calls Union Grove Holdings 3, and it's already putting the capital to work. The fund has closed nearly $4.1 million from three investors, according to a securities disclosure. Greg Bolin, who co-founded Union Grove in 2014, says the investment thesis is the same with the new money, targeting between $1 million and $8 million in direct investments while also funneling equity into venture capital funds. Bolin says the firm's winning strategy at 29.2% net internal rate of return at year end is what helps it win investors. We have been very selective, he says. The money from the third round is already being doled out, including to a company developing a fish alternative. Union Grove recently invested in Current Foods, a firm Bolin calls kind of the Beyond Meat of the ocean. Firm hit by Durham's Duke Street explosion will shutter North Carolina plant. A construction software company, once headquartered in Durham but forced out after a gas line explosion hit its corporate office, has decided to shutter a plant in nearby Alamance County. Prescient, whose five-dimensional software can design buildings up to 16 stories tall, had moved its headquarters from Denver to Durham in 2017. Then in April 2019, following the deadly explosion on Duke Street at its building, it moved its headquarters to Charlotte. This month, Prescient notified the state it will permanently close its plant on Senator Ralph Scott Parkway in Mebane, a move impacting 83 employees. And finally, semiconductor firm taps Morrisville for expansion. More than 15 years after seemingly winding down its Durham operation, a Japanese semiconductor firm is again expanding and hiring in the Triangle. The U.S. subsidiary of Renesas Electronics Corporation has signed a 90,000-square-foot lease at Morrisville's 4542 building, an expansion according to a statement by Ross Lube, director of real estate and facilities at the company. Renesas has made bets on the region before. The Tokyo-based semiconductor firm used to operate a Durham design center, but shuttered the operation in 2005, shifting its projects to other facilities in California, Japan, and Vietnam. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page written by Zach Ezone. With downtown hot, Shaw looks to rise. The HBCU is looking at high-rise options for valuable land. Shaw University is starting a process that could allow for the development of buildings up to 30 or 40 stories on parts of its campus. The historically black university in downtown Raleigh wants to convert as much of its 28-acre campus to a different type of mixed-use zoning that allows for greater development flexibility as nearby construction booms. Additionally, Shaw plans to remove several parcels of property from an overlay district that places constraints on development. These proposed changes are part of an ongoing effort to review and evaluate the land Shaw owns downtown to determine how it could be better utilized. Earlier this year, Shaw selected Hyatt Brown, a national advisory firm based in Washington, D.C., to assist with this process. This proposed rezoning is the next step of this effort, says Kevin Sullivan, the university's vice president for real estate and strategic development. The whole goal is to leverage Shaw's real estate, he says. The best way to leverage that is to remove as much risk as possible for any private developers that come in. The existing office mixed-use zoning covering campus limits Shaw's facilities to their current height from 3 to 12 stories, depending on the property. The university is proposing changing this to zoning that allows for between 7 and 40 stories. The request also includes converting a small residential lot to mixed-use zoning that allows for development up to 3 stories. Additionally, the university wants to remove several of its properties from the Prince Hall Historic Overlay District, which places certain restrictions on development, including limiting building height. Sullivan says the university had requested it not be included in the district when it was originally created in 2012. Successfully making these changes doesn't mean Shaw's campus will be filled exclusively with 40-story towers. As Sullivan says, the university still wants to maintain green space and its historic buildings. Instead, these proposed changes would give Shaw flexibility when approaching developers and evaluating the best uses for its properties. Shaw is bordered by downtown mixed-use zoning to its north and west. High-rise developments are being planned near the campus, including a 12-story hotel and a 20-story apartment building. To the east and south, the university borders residential property. Lawsuit fighting Duke University over clinic takeover dropped. A Duke University doctor and faculty member submitted a motion in court May 9 to dismiss a lawsuit that he had filed accusing the university of engaging in unlawful and unfair tactics in its attempt to take over the affiliated but independent private diagnostic clinic. A judge approved the dismissal May 12. Dr. Eugene Moretti, an anesthesiologist at the PDC, filed the suit in December, accusing Duke of trying to take control of the clinic without paying fair value after failed attempts to acquire it. According to the initial complaint, the practice of 1,850 doctors generates about $1 billion in revenue. Duke health officials claimed the lawsuit had no basis in fact or law and was filed by an individual who was not representative of PDC leadership, and they said a potential alignment had been discussed for months. Now it appears Duke and the PDC have agreed to work out a deal. Chimeric stock slides after deal. About a year after receiving approval from federal regulators, a Durham biopharmaceutical company plans to sell its lone product, a smallpox treatment, in a deal worth up to $337.5 million to fund other pipelines. Chimerix announced May 16 a deal with Emergent BioSolutions of Maryland that would see the latter acquire exclusive worldwide rights to Tembexa, a drug the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved in June. As part of the deal, Chimerix will receive $225 million upfront, plus up to an additional $112.5 million in milestone payments. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Deepak Kumar, director of NC Central University's Julius L. Chambers Biomedical Biotechnology Research Institute, on the focus of a recent partnership with RTI International. Certain populations are more exposed because of the locations where they live. That creates inequities. That needs to be addressed. And finally, a big number, $82 million. That's how much Vesteron, an ag tech company that moved its headquarters to Research Triangle Park 3 years ago, has raised to advance its efforts of developing crop protection products based on peptides, which are small proteins. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. There are a lot of things wrong in there. New owner to update unsafe Raleigh Hotel near Walnut Creek. The Quality Inn Raleigh, located near the Coastal Credit Union Music Park at Walnut Creek, was sold on May 4 for $4.4 million to NG Hospitality LLC of Cary. By May 9, city officials had posted signs at the hotel stating the building was determined to be unsafe following inspections. The hotel has had 14 inspections since the start of the year, with violations including a lack of working smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors. When Sherry Comberry, founder of NG Hospitality, purchased the property, he was not aware of the building's issues, he says. Kambara bought the hotel at an auction. The hotel has 30 days to make all of the necessary changes to bring the building up to code, says Charles Williams, assistant fire marshal for the Raleigh Fire Department. At that point, the hotel could reopen and operate as normal, but Kambara isn't doing that. Instead, he's putting about $1 million into renovating the building over at least 3 months. There are a lot of things wrong in there. I'm going to renovate the whole property, including the colors, the furniture, Kambara says. I'm going to upscale the whole place so that business travelers and travelers who come for the amphitheater or the Amazon Business Center will come here. The 60-room hotel was built in 1996 and was previously owned by AHKH LLC of Wake Forest. The company is registered to Harish Giwala. Giwala was made aware of the violations and given time to make the necessary changes multiple times, Williams says. We gave them ample time during our routine and repetitive inspections, he says. I can't answer to why he did not want to correct those violations and let it get to this point. The Quality Inn is the second hotel Canberra has purchased. The first, owned under a different company name, is located in High Point. The Raleigh Hotel will continue to operate under the Quality Inn brand due to contract obligations with Choice Hotels International. New brewery, part of big development plans. Grain Dealers Brewery is planning to bring concerts and nightlife to downtown Dunn. Founders Wesley Johnson and Lee Honeycutt are eyeing a historic property for the project and have launched a crowdfunding campaign to support the plans. A bar, kitchen, and dining space are planned for the 9,000-square-foot building, previously home to Dunn Lumber Company. The one-acre lot will also feature a food truck park, a stage and concert seating, and the brewery. As part of the City of Dunn's strategic vision plan, the city purchased the property for $150,000 in April. The Grain Dealers crowdfunding campaign has raised 36% of its minimum goal of $300,000. The campaign ends June 30. At that time, Johnson is hoping to purchase the property from the city. The team will first renovate the building to be used as a rentable event space. Raleigh program gains new tenants. The pop-up shops at Martin Street, a program in downtown Raleigh for minority and women-owned businesses, has named new retailers. The partnership between Startup at Wake Tech, LM Restaurants, and the Downtown Raleigh Alliance offers short-term leases at 17 East Martin Street. Lenovo has been brought on as the program's presenting sponsor. Sir Chance's Vintage and Secondhand is graduating from the program and moving to its own brick-and-mortar location at 206 South Wilmington Street. The 1,230-square-foot space will now hold beauty supply shop Tress Life, and the Bath Place will be selling artisan soaps, skincare products, and candles. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Donald Thompson, board chair for Walk West, on naming Abba Bowers the new CEO. Bowers was senior vice president at the Raleigh Marketing Agency and will succeed interim CEO Karen Albritton. After conducting a national search, the board realized we had a diamond in our midst. And finally, a big number. 16. The number of years Vietnamese restaurant Lime and Basil's was on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, the locally owned restaurant, a favorite among locals, closed in April in an area known for its high turnover among tenants. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice column, which covers Cody Kinsley. The headline, NC Native Leads Top State Health Agency. Cody Kinsley follows Dr. Mandy Cohen as head of Department of Health and Human Services. Although he may not be a doctor, the new leader of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has years of experience shaping health care policy. Governor Roy Cooper selected Cody Kinsley to fill the role of NCDHHS Secretary in late November after Dr. Mandy Cohen stepped down. Kinsley had been the department's chief deputy secretary for health and led its COVID-19 operations. Kinsley joined the department in 2018 after serving in multiple roles with the federal government. Kinsley, who is from Wilmington and is also the first openly gay cabinet secretary in the state's history, began his career with a behavioral health care company in the western part of the state. How has your career shaped your approach to leading DHHS? The last decade has really been focused on health policy and coming at it from a variety of different perspectives, making large systems work and deliver maximum value. When we think about health care and my $26 billion budget here at the Department of Health and Human Services, a lot of what we do is not done by us. It is done through our partners. It is done by financing. Doing that in a strategic and intelligent way, seeing that as an investment to get an outcome, is a key way in which I approach things. How did you get interested in healthcare policy? I was not insured as a child, which of course I didn't know what that meant. I only knew that going to the doctor was a labored decision for my parents. Was the arm hurt or was it broken? Was the throat sore or was it strep? Navigating those healthcare access points were very challenging and stressful. It really shaped my experience that it seemed like health was a great equalizer, that our ability to be healthy was the underpinning of our ability to really survive in society. Have those experiences impacted your priorities? I think back to our COVID response. We started with over 1 million people without health insurance in our state. Think about telling people to get tested. It's free. Well, If you've lived your life uninsured, then you never believe anything in the health system is free. Or if you're told, get a vaccine, if you have questions, talk to your doctor. What doctor? Trying to tackle policy problems through the lens of really where everything comes together on the ground is my priority. What are your priorities at DHHS? One is behavioral health. Coming out of a global pandemic where every person has been impacted, we're going to have a woodwork effect, and we have significant lack of access problems. If we don't treat mental health issues, they turn into more severe mental health issues, and then they become other healthcare issues. I'm trying to control future costs by getting ahead of it and investing in behavioral health up front. Big Bucket 2 is a strong and inclusive workforce. We're in the tightest labor market in a generation. We have to deal with the fact that we have a healthcare labor force that was already on borrowed time and begin the work of getting us on a better trajectory to serve an aging and growing population here in North Carolina. Third is focusing on children. We've had a generation of children impacted by this pandemic. This goes back to my investment strategy. You can change the health of a state and a generation with an intense focus on kids. What is the impact of the heightened focus on public health during the pandemic? My hope is that we can parlay that interest and that focus into real partnerships with the business community, with the nonprofit community, with advocacy groups to cut across what I believe to be universal objectives. We all want a healthy workforce. We all want healthy babies and children. We all want to take care of people with mental illness, and we all want to get away from what has been this pernicious substance use disorder issue. Where is the state in its recovery path? The tension has always been throughout this pandemic that people have wanted an on and off switch. And what we know is these things are more like dimmer switches than light switches. We are edging our way out of this pandemic posture, but we're never going to be quite done. We're more and more managing this like we manage other diseases that are communicable and that we live with. And this interview was conducted by Zach Ezone. In a closer look, age, 36, hometown, Wilmington, education, bachelor's degree, Brevard College, Master of Public Policy, University of California at Berkeley, appointed November 30, 2021, began role January 1, previous role at NCDHHS, Chief Deputy Secretary for Health, led COVID-19 operations, top priorities, behavioral health, child and family well-being, strong and inclusive workforce, department employees, 18,000. Department budget, $26 billion. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page. First article written by Cliff Barnes. Texas firm scoops up warehouse, building used by Amazon Wake Tech trades for $46 million. An industrial warehouse in Raleigh that houses a Wake Tech Community College Education Center and an Amazon Fulfillment Center has been sold to a private equity firm in Texas for $46.75 million. Pennybacker Capital Management, based in Austin with offices in Charlotte, Denver, and New York, purchased the 19.79-acre property at 3200 Bush Street from New Market Strategies of Stuart, Florida, according to a Wake County deed recorded May 12. In 2016, Roy Warren, New Market's president, bought the land and the 252,000-square-foot warehouse, built in 1967, for more than $20 million. The latest property assessment has the total value at $25.36 million. The fully leased property, located along the Interstate 440 Beltline in Northeast Raleigh, is also home to a Lennox parts store, a Richards building supply location, and a healthcare wellness solutions. The largest tenant is Wake Tech's Beltline Education Center, or BEC, which occupies 81,090 square feet, or more than 36% of the building. BEC is the hub of operations for Wake Tech's Workforce Continuing Education Division. It houses Wake Tech's College and Career Readiness Programs and the Wake Works Apprenticeship Training Center. The center has customized training space for businesses and individuals and is equipped with mechatronics and robotics equipment. The School of Cosmetology has a salon staffed by students and is open to the public. The next largest tenant is Amazon, which occupies about 30,000 square feet, used for an Amazon Prime rapid delivery service for the Raleigh area. Pennybacker Capital was founded in 2006 by Tim Berry, who had been a restructuring advisor for Deloitte. The firm has executed more than $5.3 billion in real estate investments. Pennybacker opened its Charlotte office just before the pandemic with plans to expand in the Southeast. Last year, the company acquired a 500,000-square-foot industrial building in Raleigh for over $55 million. CBRE Raleigh, represented by Grayson Hawkins, Chandler Hawkins, Patrick Gildea, and Matt Smith were the advisors on the Bush Street warehouse transaction. Cary Office Park eyed for Life Sciences Hub. This is also written by Cliff Barnes. The owners of 11 parcels, totaling nearly 75 acres off Airport Boulevard, are asking the town of Cary to rezone the property to allow for a bigger focus on life sciences space. AEW Capital Management, a Boston real estate investment company founded in 1981 through its four Aerial Center LLCs, is looking to rezone the property from general commercial and office institutional use to office research and development conditional use. Nearly 38 acres of the property is vacant, while the Aerial Center Executive Park, with 10 office buildings, sits on the remainder. Seven buildings, 2,000, 2,701, 3,000, 4,000, 4,020, 8,001, and 9,001 Aerial Center, have nine lease spaces available, totaling more than 97,000 square feet. According to the flyer describing the properties, JLL handles the leasing. The Spectrum Companies, founded in 1982 in Charlotte, provides property management for the Aerial Center Executive Park tenants. And in general news, Durham gene therapy firm raises $270 million to support growth, written by Zach Ezone. As it prepares to advance into clinical trials, a growing gene therapy company with a headquarters in Research Triangle Park has added $270 million to its coffers. The completion of its Series C financing means Kria Therapeutics has raised $450 million in the last 2 years. This follows the company with about 160 employees raising $80 million in 2020 and $100 million in 2021. CEO Shankar Ramaswamy says the company will use the new financing to move its product candidates into clinical trials, expand the number of candidates in its pipeline through internal development and acquisitions or partnerships, and refine the company's computational and manufacturing platforms. The company, which has a manufacturing facility and research and development space off Hobson Road, is focused on four disease targets: oncology, ophthalmology, rare disease, and chronic disease. While 70% of its employees are based in North Carolina, Kria also operates a headquarters in California. Since launching in 2020, Kria has built out its core capabilities, infrastructure, and a pipeline of gene therapy programs through internal development and acquisitions or partnerships. For instance, the company in January completed the acquisition of Duke University spinout Warden Bio, which is developing gene therapies for glycogen storage disorders. Through this acquisition, Kria obtained the rights to Warden's five preclinical gene therapy programs to serve as the foundation of the company's new rare disease division. Kria has a number of programs expected to enter the clinic for trials next year. Ultimately, Ramaswamy says the company is attempting to build an engine that can deliver dozens of gene therapy products across several diseases. Ramaswamy says peak efficiency would mean Kria could move programs from concept to the clinic in 2 years or less, depending on the specific program. That's different from academia, where it can take a decade, he says. Part of that is we all have the resources committed to this type of engine and activity. Building out the transformative company is a costly endeavor. Gene therapy has been around for some time, but only a few products have been approved. This latest round of financing was led by Patient Square Capital, with participation from Bluebird Ventures, CAM Capital, Dexcel Pharma, Foresight Capital, JDRF T1D Fund, Light Switch Capital, Narya Capital, QVT, Transhuman Capital, and other undisclosed investors. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where in this edition we have a guest notebook column written by Amalindu Chatterjee, who is founder of ExumSoft International. The headline: North Carolina must think big to avoid future gridlock. President Joe Biden's $1.2 trillion transportation infrastructure bill feels like it's a lot. After all the slicing and dicing, it does not look like that much to cover all present and future requirements. Unfortunately, two key elements are missing: a new railway infrastructure and grid connection of renewable energy, which are essential for a visionary system. Yes, the transportation industry has evolved to be a complex puzzle of many pieces, but also expensive. Competing puzzles are short-term fixes of existing roads and bridges versus long-term visions that could last for another 100 years. In the 1950s, President Dwight Eisenhower used the growing automobile industry and married it with the only resource we had back then, gas, and created the nation's interstate highways with bridges. That building of highway infrastructure created an economic boom in all states after World War II. It was financed by gas taxes. Even with high gas taxes, highways and bridges could not keep up. Currently, the American Society of Civil Engineers, or ASCE, grades the existing infrastructure below grade C. ASCE also predicted the existing infrastructure, it may never reach a grade B, even with all the additional money. Using the fund to meet the past transportation budget deficit will be the wrong approach. We need an innovative and aggressive approach for a new railway infrastructure parallel to the existing road-centric or even a competing air commute infrastructure. We need an infrastructure to connect available technology such as autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, light rail, high-speed rail, broadband internet, etc. And now our available resources are renewable energy, vast land assets in rural areas, and upgradable existing railway tracks or new tracks with new parking areas away from the congested cities. All of these will be required for automated transportation of the future. This backup infrastructure should run in parallel with existing road and city-centric highway infrastructure. The now defunct 17-mile Durham Orange Light Rail project can serve as a role model as a good start. Job creation, low-income housing development, relocation of city parking along the railway track, and GDP growth analysis of the project showed tremendous potential, including new tax revenues. One can learn a lesson from the NC Information Superhighway, or NCIS, of 1990 for distance learning and telemedicine. I may be one of very few survivors who was involved in planning and executing the NCIS on behalf of Fujitsu during the broadband internet high-tech boom. Players involved were federal and state agencies, Fujitsu, and Bell South. During the COVID epidemic, NCIS provided a tremendous service to businesses as well as educational institutions. Imagine where we would have been without such infrastructure. What does it teach us? North Carolina should go to the limit. The limit is first regional transportation, then interregional transportation, and then an interstate transportation system interconnecting all available technologies. For example, all cities such as Cary, Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill should relate to light rail. High-speed rail should connect the light rail regional system to the interregional system to extend to other major cities such as Greensboro, Charlotte, and Wilmington. Once such plans are completed, one can extend interstate cooperation using high-speed rail to back up commuter airlines. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by John Hood, who is a John Locke Foundation board member in Raleigh. The headline, "Only Legislatures Can Rein in Congress." To paraphrase the old saying, you may not be interested in the federal debt, but the federal debt is interested in you. There's abundant evidence for this proposition right now as prices continue to soar for food, fuel, housing, and other necessities. Inflation consists of too much money chasing too few goods and services. So President Joe Biden is right to observe that limitation on supply, some originating with the COVID-19 pandemic, are part of the problem. His observation is doing himself no political good, however, because Biden seems unwilling to do anything of consequence to boost the supply of goods and services. Federal politicians of both parties share the blame. Although they talk a good game about fiscal discipline, they rarely practice it. State lawmakers don't have that luxury. Here in North Carolina, for example, the governor is legally required to submit an operating budget in which expected revenues exceed planned expenditures. The General Assembly, in turn, is legally required to enact such a budget. If during the ensuing year an operating deficit occurs, the governor is further required to close it by tapping reserves or cutting spending. We voters have often promoted politicians from state to federal office, hoping that they'd retain their commitment to fiscal probity, only to be disappointed with the results. That's because we focus too much on the character of our representatives rather than on the institutions within which they make decisions. We thought leaders would do the right We thought leaders would do the right thing, even if it wasn't required. We were mistaken. That's why I've come to believe that the only practical solution to the problem of rampant deficits is something that may seem at first to be wildly impractical. We need to amend the United States Constitution. We need to impose a balanced budget requirement on Congress and the President, enforceable either by federal courts or state legislatures or both. It's not a new idea. Activists of various political stripes have proposed balanced budget amendments to the federal Constitution for decades. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson suggested something like it as early as 1798. Not only does almost every American state operate under such a requirement, but a number of European countries have either balanced budget rules or borrowing caps imposed by law. Do politicians find ways to evade them? Of course. That's even happened in North Carolina from time to time, though not lately. But a less than perfect rule is better than no rule at all. Moreover, even I think that Washington should be able to borrow to build long-lived assets such as aircraft carriers or to finance deficits during wars or other national emergencies. A federal balanced budget rule must be carefully designed to keep these reasonable exceptions from destroying the rule. As lawmakers return to Raleigh this month for their 2022 short session, they ought to give Senate Bill 414 a serious look. It would add North Carolina to a multi-state compact. If enough states sign on, that would trigger a constitutional convention to enact a balanced budget amendment. It's the only answer, and it's time to stop dodging the question. And as we have a few minutes left, we'll go back and read one of the Life Sciences Awards. Most Innovative Clinical Research Organization, ICVIA. Age of firm, 40 years. Description, provides clinical research services to the life sciences industry. What drove your firm's growth in the past year? ICVIA delivered a 22.1% increase in revenue for 2021 versus 2020. This growth was driven by a record year of net new business and research and development solutions, R&DS, and double-digit revenue growth for the year in both R&DS and technology and analytics solutions, TAS. Our growth is underpinned by biopharmaceutical companies seeking to speed drug development, get the right treatment to patients, and improve access and delivery of healthcare. Complete the following statement. Since its inception, the firm is most proud of its shared commitment to improve patient lives. Each day, our colleagues dedicate themselves to empower clinical experts to create more innovative, more precise, and faster clinical development solutions. This commitment allows us to help our customers bring needed treatments to patients. What upcoming initiative or milestone are you most looking forward to in 2022 to 23? Formerly, we were bringing patients to clinical trials, and now we are able to bring trials to patients. We are continuing to remove barriers and burdens of trial participation by fitting the trial into patients' daily lives through eliminating unnecessary visits and optimizing technology like wearable devices. We're excited to continue this journey this year to make trials easier for patients, which will in turn bring needed treatments to market more quickly. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, we have the Business Pulse Survey. The question, what should the future of PNC Arena and the surrounding area look like? Total number of responses, 210. 48% say the area should be developed to better serve the arena just beyond just paved parking. 22% say the priority should be upgrades to the arena. 20% say it's time for a new arena somewhere else in the city. And 10% say the arena is fine just the way it is. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.